Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Victory Over Self Radio. Victory Over Self, a podcast that dives into all things athletics. Today, we are honored and very pleased to have on the man himself, Connor Shepp. Now, you may have come across Connor through the Googlings or some articles on Sportsmith dealing with some rehab or some return to play type of protocols. You may have found him on his phenomenal social medias, which I highly recommend you go out and give a follow. And you may have just been someone Googling things because somebody got hurt and you're a little bit interested on the good and the proper ways of returning them. We're very excited, Connor. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, boys. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So first question, just kind of get it out there. The people have been writing in and they want to know, how does it feel living in the same city for more than a year?
It's been fun, man. It's been a newer experience for me for, the past couple of years. For those not familiar with my story, I've kind of bounced around for, I think eight or nine moves in like 10 years now. And I've been coming up on Liberty here in July, it'll be 3 years. So it's been really good to kind of lay some roots down for a little while. It was fun to do while I was young. Definitely. I got to go to some cool places, Miami, Phoenix, some of those cooler spots, but I don't recommend it for everybody. It's a battle, but I'm happy to be here.
Now, if it makes you feel better, I talk about you very often with interns and students, just to kind of lay out like, hey, if you want to really make it in this field, you might have to move a lot. Connor, for example, and then I list out a little bit of the coast to coast resume and stuff like that. So if you were, what you are, if you're in a position to speak to an intern or even an undergraduate master's level student here at Liberty, and you kind of reflect on your career so far, what are some of the things where you're like, this was unbelievable, absolutely do this? Or are there any kind of like cautionary tales you might throw out?
Yeah, man, I would say so. Like, this is the first thing I tell all interns, is figure out if you love it. Because I don't think this field, if I'm being honest, is for everybody, right? And I think that's like a harsh reality for some people to admit, right? But you guys know, like, there's a lot of really good things. Like, I'll say this, man, like, coaching has brought more joy to my life than I could ever give back to it, right? Like, it's an unbelievable, and like, the only reason that I continue to do it is because I derive so much joy from it. But that doesn't mean it comes without its pitfalls. Like, it's a really oversaturated field right now. The jobs are scarce, the pay is, more oftentimes than not going to be pretty low. The respect amongst peers is going to be, diminished at times, right? Depending upon where you're at, unfortunately. Get out there, get exposure, figure out like, hey, is this something I want to do? And then just understand that it is going to be tough, right? And that doesn't mean like, it can't be done. But just understand like it may have to suck for a couple years before, you feel like you're in a good position and you feel that, you can kind of solidify yourself in a spot and start to, build on that. And then the next thing, man, is just find good people to work for. Like, so much, and I can just speak from my own experience of like, your joy and your growth is going to be dictated by the person you go work for. So do your research. Like, don't just, I live in this area, so I'm going to go intern at this place because, they need help. Right. And like, I understand different people have different financial, responsibilities and things like that, man. But like, I think starting off your career and finding good people that are going to help nurture your growth and, help you kind of take that next step in your career, man. Like, I wouldn't be anywhere if someone hadn't done that for me, which is why I'm so gung ho about like our internship program and like trying to help coaches like actually find that next spot and actually develop as coaches. So that.
Yeah, no, and it's phenomenal advice, and so many things go through my head hearing that. So we'll give a little background here. I'll make a couple comments, and then we'll pass it over to Ross. But I had the good fortune here for the listeners, and then Blair and Ross, of very recently being able to hear you present at the NSCA State Clinic here in Virginia. Just an awesome presentation, kind of taking us through the whole ACL rehab story. But what I was benefited by was the athlete you were talking about was sitting right next to me and then some other guys on that team. And as you were going through slides, what stood out to me is when it was like a cool drill or whatever, the athletes literally said out loud, like, oh, that's really cool. So just a reminder for me and for everybody out there, like as coaches, the athletes' opinions of things like really do matter. Like they will buy into certain things if it's fun, if it's cool to them or whatever. But you mentioned just how much coaching has given back to you. And you could tell the emotion that you had giving that presentation of like you were on the grind with this athlete coming back from an ACL surgery. And you could feel it too, the emotion that that athlete had, like recapping that story and reliving that. So yeah, man, just as coaches, there's just so many moments where we can impact people. And I just, you know, hear it from me for whatever it's worth. I felt that. I'm sure everybody else in the audience felt that coming from you. And then just being able to be around the team and the athlete in particular, it was a really cool, really different experience getting to hear that whole presentation. So just thank you from all the athletes that you get to touch and work with. And with that being said, the main kind of sport that you're with is soccer. And so Ross being down in Texas, obviously a really big football, but also soccer area. And he just cannot wait to pelt you with some questions there. So Ross, let's take it away here, brother, and get into some nitty gritty.
Yeah, and before we get into that, Connor, I always like to ask coaches, and you don't need to go super detailed, but man, who are some of the kind of the big coaches that have influenced you over your time?
Oh, yeah, man. I could be here all day with this one.
we all could.
Yeah. So I'll say a couple, man. Along the way specifically, I bounced around a lot of places, kind of trying to find a gig for, you know, a couple of years before, you know, I finally came across a group of guys at Mississippi State that really took me under their wing and really, you know, put their name on me and went out of the way to help me a lot. Anthony Paroli, who's a director at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers now. Corey Bechet is his assistant there now. Mike Stacchiotti at the University of Pittsburgh. Let's see, Buddy Morris at Arizona. Henry Barrera here at Liberty. Rob Hornet here at Liberty. You know, I'm missing, I could name three dozen more people, but I would say those are guys specifically, man, that without question, I would not be in the position I'm in now without them. So forever great and grateful to them.
Awesome. Yeah, those are that's some good names right there. And so with that, if people aren't familiar, a bunch of your role is the return to play and whatnot, but you also train men's soccer up there. For you, and when you think of with soccer training and what you got going on, especially at the Division I level, you're getting these guys, and man, this is all they do and or all they've ever done. For you, what do you think you need to have that's unique to soccer training, and then like what's going to be similar kind of across the board in your programming?
Yeah, man, so I think, you know, like obviously, you know, I think specifically like because a lot of my experiences in American football where you have these like 8 month long periods to train these guys to get them ready to play, like I think it's hilarious when I hear like football coaches, like especially at the higher levels, like talk about like how challenging it is, and it is it's different challenges, but like, you know, on this side, man, like these kids never stop playing their sports year round. Like, and I know you work with some girls that play like club soccer year round and high school soccer year round. It's like, you're lucky to see them once or twice a week, if that, depending upon the time of year. So like, you know, from that perspective, man, like it's definitely, you know, I think each sector is its own challenging kind of environment. But at the end of the day, man, like, you know, principles are principles. Movement is movement. Right? Like there's offense, there's defense, there's transition, they're sprinting, they're cutting. Like a lot of the demands are the same. I think like where a little bit more of the specificity comes in is like actually reverse engineering the sport in terms of like, okay, like what can we afford to continue to work on while they're, you know, keeping the main thing, the main thing. Right. So like for me, like the unique thing about soccer is like, you know, just looking at like from a research standpoint, if we're looking at work and if work is just, you know, this ambiguous number of like distance and sprinting and cutting and all these different things. Like men's soccer has the highest amount of workload in comparison to other sports across college athletics. right? Especially from like a high speed distance running demand. It's a very, very challenging thing, right? To try to balance those things out of training stressors as well as, you know, what they're doing out on the field. So I would say that would be the biggest challenge for me is finding ways to be agile in the programming, and continue to fill those buckets with consistent development without ever taking away from what they're actually here to do, right? Because that's like the first thing I tell my guys when they get here, like anything you do with me is just a means to an end of being more resilient and trying to improve performance. You know, like if I can, you know, improve movement quality, increase resilience, raise output a little bit without interfering with the technical and tactical aspect, man, like to me, that's really all my job is.
Yeah, and I think you made a huge point there of, generally speaking, man, soccer's workload is massive. You know, they're doing a ton of work. And when you look at distance covered and the high-speed stuff, yeah, they're covering a ton of distance, and naturally a lot of it's walking. Yeah. And, you know, not necessarily a jogging per se. But it is a lot of quick bursts and quick movements, so a lot of speed and naturally a large aerobic base. And so you touched on it a little bit. Well, before I get to that, Coach, what are some of the big things that you see lacking in your incoming freshmen, whether it's a movement thing, whether it's a physical thing, a conditioning thing? You know, what are some of the big things that you're seeing?
Yeah, so specifically the soccer players, and, you know, they're not too unique in that regards to other freshmen coming in, right? Like, the big ones are just poor movement competency, poor just general capacity, poor general strength, right? Like, it's especially for a sport like soccer, it's a little better on the American side, but just a lack of just, you know, general physical foundational qualities, right? And that's not unique to them. Specifically things that, you know, like we feel like that we have to address early on is just lumbopelvic control. That's a big one for me. Soccer players are generally very overly compressed just due to the nature of all the submaximal loading that they do. And just really, like, probably the biggest one is just the lack of exposure to, like, high intensity things, right? They just, like, if you know anything about soccer and you're listening to this, you know that, like, they love just the submaximal, like, change of directions, the ladders, the getting touches on the ball, man. Like, some of these kids, man, like, it's crazy to me, especially if you play in the midfield, like, they'll go months without ever actually opening up and sprinting or, like, grabbing something that's, like, even remotely heavy, right? So just, like, I'd say those are the big rocks, you know, it's, especially when they come in, that we'll kind of try to just hammer.
Yeah, man, the touch and the speed work is massive. One, obviously, we all know this from a health perspective, and two, from an exposure. You know, I'm a huge believer in getting kids used to high intensity things. Not a ton of reps, you know, low volume, but I think it kind of gets missed a lot, particularly in the high school population. It can be of, you know, some of these soccer kids, I mean, they're literally doing 20 hours a week of stuff all the time. And as you said, balancing that training with the club season, and it's really tough to do on top of, I think right now in the high school setting for soccer is that club has taken such a huge part of the workload, and that high school is almost a back burner, and where what a high school coach says is kind of irrelevant to what the club coach is saying, regardless of what their experiences are and what we're trying to do and make it work and balance. Mm-hmm. I find that from a training side, it's very interesting when a coach meets me or talks to me and they don't know me. One, what they're seeing is probably not what they envisioned, not some big lunked out dude. And then when I can magically explain everything that we do, they're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. I'm like, yeah, they just got to show up and do it. And I work with, and we do a good job balancing. And so this would be my last kind of general question, Connor, and then we'll transition here. Totally, just generally speaking, man, because we're dealing with multiple games a week with soccer. Generally speaking, what do you think is a good layout for both your training and, say, just a practice schedule, whether it's a day away, 2 days away, 3 days away, kind of what's your general philosophy when you're in that in-season training schedule?
Yeah, so in my setting, it's a little bit more unique than not more. It's just unique in the sense that we really only have one season that matters, right? And that's our fall season. Our guys will go play on summer teams that really don't do much for them besides make them tired. We'll play a really short spring season. We'll play like four or five scrimmages. But at the end of the day, like You know, no one ever asked how many games you won in the spring. So, like, we really have only about, like, 2.5-3 months of, like, legit, like, soccer, like, hey, like, it's all on the line here, which is unique in the soccer world because, like, you know, for most kids, it's just year-round constant. For us, we get to, you know, really kind of hone in on that. But once we get into that grind, it's very agile, right? So I'll say from, like, a training standpoint, what we've kind of worked towards is, like, we have certain kinds of sessions, right? And it breaks up. We have regen sessions, which would be like the day after a game. Okay, I'm a believer in bringing kids in the day after and then the rest day being -2, right? I just think from what I've found from research that that's shown the highest mitigation risk for injury. I don't think you're necessarily wrong for taking that rest day right after either. You know, travel, there's a lot of things that go into that, but that's generally what we try to do, right? And then we have re-entry days. Right. So anytime kids are coming off a day off, we generally try to keep things. We slow things down a little bit. We lean in a little bit more of the technical aspect, some more passing, some more walk and talk type things. Right. It's a little bit of a lower day in general. Our +3 days. Right. Or really anything greater than +3, +4, or +5. Those are going to be our most intense sessions. Right. We're 72 hours out from match day. So we understand that we can get a little bit more out of them. We can push it a little bit. The spaces will probably be a little bit smaller, right? A lot more decels, a lot more combative work. Like, the guys are going to walk away from those sessions sore the next day, right? -2, we'll probably spread it back out a little bit, all right? Duration and volume is going to be pretty similar, but we're going to open up the field a little bit more distance, a little bit more high-speed running, which, in my opinion, is actually a little bit less taxing peripherally, centrally. Depending upon the exposure, it may be a little bit more if they, you know, have an opportunity to make a run. And then +1 is just going to be short and intense, right? Just, you know, call it a primer if you want to do that, but just 30 to 40 minutes of, hey, let's get out there. Let's play really intense. Let's play really fast. Let's get ready to go play a game, right? And then how lifting, I guess the physical aspect fits into that. Anytime we are -2, +3 or +2, I'll try to get a high speed exposure in season. And for me, man, it's just, you know, really minimal effective dose. Can I get like 2 really good 20 to 25 yard sprints out of you? Hopefully I can time it. But even if not, man, like if you're not feeling good, it's optional for them. You know, if you got a tight hip flexor, if you got a hamstring, something going on, completely optional. I've made that mistake of like, hey, like, no, like we have to do this. Juice isn't worth the squeeze, in my opinion. And then from a weight room standpoint, +3s. So like the easiest way I could probably say this, like in this, you know, if we're playing one game a week, I'll get 2 lift exposures. If we're playing 2 games a week, I'll get 1. If we're 3+, if I can get them on a 3+ day, I know I'm going to be able to hit their lower body. All right. With some dynamic contractions. So just like a trap bar deadlift is our primary. Right. If I get them on day 2 or 2+, we'll stay on the trap bar, but I'll either take it to dynamic effort or an overcoming pin pull just to still get some sort of stimulus and delay some of that, like, or I guess mitigate some of that peripheral fatigue. And then if it's day 1, if I can only get them on day 1 out, we'll just do like an upper body session, right? So it's very, very agile. And then within that, we'll have 4 programs going on for each one of those sessions, I should say. We'll have an advanced program, which is really just any of my returners, so sophomores are up. We'll have an entry-level program for our guys that, you know, just got here, our first years. And then those will also be broken up into high-minute and low-minute players, which for us is roughly about anything over than 40 minutes you get put into the high-minute group. Anything under that you get put in the low-minute group. So it's 4 separate programs and very agile on any given day based upon how we are, how far we are from game days.
That's really smart. I like that. I want to touch a little bit on, for your high speed exposure, mm-hmm. You're doing that 20, 25-ish yards.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you feel you ever need to go further than that? Or do you think that because basically in that range, those girls are probably at 90% or more of their top speed, that that's enough distance? Or do you think you sometimes may or may not need to go further than that? If that makes sense, what I'm asking.
No, absolutely. I just think for me, I have been bitten by it in the end at times where, you know, I've pushed the distance and, you know, we've had a hamstring or we've had you know, some things pop up, some cramping, whatever it is. So just like, ideally, yes, I would love to get them over that, but you know, we'll also track peak velocity exposure kind of throughout the week. Right. And so like, you know, just like anyone else, like, can we get two exposures over 90% of your peak velocity? Right. And my outside players, they actually do that. Like, you're a center back, outside back, striker, forward, whatever it is, like, they're going to get an exposure at least in a game. And if we're getting two games, like, I know they're going to be able to touch it. I'm not really concerned about them. It's really my midfielders that never get that exposure because they just kind of, you know, they pretty much just jog back and forth between the lines for like 2 hours. It's insane. So, but yeah, for me, like, I'll generally keep it in that 20 to 25. And then if I want to take out the distance, I'll probably put them on wickets just because I know that while it may diminish the speed a little bit, I know it's going to mitigate, you know, maybe some poor postures that could come back to bite them.
That's really good. That's a great idea. Yeah. Kerr, on to you, buddy.
Yeah, real quick along that, do you still have your hand in the football world at all? And kind of what I'm asking is, like, have you seen a high school layout that a lot of coaches are doing where, like, they take Wednesdays off or anything like that?
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, I'm trying to think here because high schools play on Fridays because, I mean, yeah. You know, there's the bit – I mean, you're obviously familiar with the Tony Holler following yeah, and the football and, consortium and that crew.
And that's where I'm hearing a lot of it. So just wondering, you know, if it kind of makes sense to you or if you have kind of influences with how you're laying out your weeks in season.
In terms of how I would do it with American football?
No, I'm just wondering of like, all right, hey, day after we want to get after it. If we're going to have a rest day, I'd prefer it be, you know, later after the game or something like that. Just kind of wondering of like where you sort of came up with that template in season or, you know, has it shifted recently or in the past or something like that?
For soccer or for football?
For soccer. Yeah.
Oh, for soccer?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So most of that research just comes from Martin Bukait, and I'm probably saying his name wrong. But if you're online, you've probably seen Martin's stuff. Mm-hmm. Just a brilliant guy that makes, like, the most, like, he takes really complicated research and puts it into, like, these really dope graphics that, like, anyone can understand, even me. So that's really for the most part where I've leaned into. I don't believe coming from American football, I grew up in high low, right? Like, I'm a Buddy Morris disciple, James Smith, Charlie Francis. Like, I thought that was everything. And when I came into soccer, I was like, no, like, we need at least 48 hours off before we can sprint again. Right. Like, what are you guys doing? Quickly found out that just doesn't work. Right. Like, the sport in itself is so inherently moderate that, like, I was trying to fit my system into their sport,
yeah,
as opposed to trying to fit my system around their sport, right? And that's why I think you see a lot of these models gravitate towards certain sports, like football. Like, in American football, it just lends itself so well to that schedule, right? Of, like, really intense, lighter, off, really intense, lighter, off. Like, that's why you see, like, especially in the college football realm, like, that's how 90% of coaches run it now. Like, if you go to any college football team in the country, like, they're probably running some sort of high low just because it fits it so well, right? And that's why you see things like the quadrant system fit into basketball so well, or like micro dosing fit into basketball so well, because it's just the nature of the sport that it fits it really well. In soccer, it's just so moderate, and just with the game demands and, you know, the chaotic schedules, you have to be, I think, so much more dynamic with some of those exposures. That's where I've just found success with kind of that setup that I talked about before.
Okay. No, that makes sense. I appreciate that. Because I do attend so many like track football consortiums, every now and then there isn't like a presentation I love, and I end up listening to a high school football coach's like weekly template. I'm just like, man, this is wild stuff. I can't believe they get away with not practicing on a Wednesday when they have a Friday game. Yeah, just really interested in how coaches kind of develop their kind of just ideas and theories and templates and stuff in and out of season. So referring back to your presentation in February here in Virginia, you said something that just like has been burned into my brain and I've wanted to ask you ever since. I was sitting in the way back. You said it, and then Kyle Jaksic, who was next to me, we both kind of looked at each other and wrote it down real quick. And I don't know if like other people picked up on it, but it was something along the lines of, I'm going to read this kind of how I quoted it out. Max strength lays down some really rigid fascial lines. Max strength lays down some really rigid fascial lines. So I have a moderate to low understanding of the fascial system, but things kind of started to make sense. Like I immediately thought of bench press and how the great bench pressers just have this, you know, specific body type. It's like, okay, are they laying down really rigid fascial lines? So anyway, give me some thoughts there. Like what in the world did that mean? What does it mean to you? How does that shape your lens as you view training?
Yeah. So funny enough. So I stole that from Ryan Grubbs. Ryan's with the Houston Texans now, former Liberty guy. Mm-hmm. Absolute brilliant dude. And I don't know where he got it from, but it just kind of intuitively made sense to me, right? Like, strength training is really, really valuable. And I think something that even the field is gravitated too far away from at this point, I think a little bit. Like there are a lot of really good benefits from getting strong, right? And strength training and spending time in that. I think specifically from a resiliency standpoint, like I think it's huge, but that doesn't mean that there's not maladaptations or negatives that come from it, right? Like if there's one thing I know to be true in training, it is you are what you emphasize, right? So like if you spend time working on a lot of grinding strength, under like heavy tensions, long time under tension, like, you know, you are going to become that, right? Like, you know, you go to any training program in the country and you watch them train, like, you know, you see those people that just, you know, spend 6 days a week under a barbell, like they're going to be stiff, right? Like things are going to look locked up. They're going to look pretty rigid, right? And if we think about like sport and the dynamic nature of it, like nothing about that is rigid, right? Even if you watch like offensive line or defensive linemen, like, yeah, there's a lot of force there, but the ground contact times and the exposures are still so short, right? Like it's so dynamic and it's so fluid. And like, if you just think of like the fascial system in general, right? Like it's, you think about like what healthy fascia looks like, you know, it's lengthened out, it's fluid, it's hydrated, right? And like, I just think that an overexposure to heavy strength training can mitigate or can have some negative effects on that. And so for me, like, especially in the rehab scenarios where like we do have to spend some serious time strength training, because we do have to build up that, you know, reserve and that resiliency. We also don't want to create a really stiff and, you know, unmobile athlete. So I just trying to like, I think going back to the thing I'd hit on in the presentation was that like, we do all this heavy strength training and then we let the athletes walk out the door and like, that's what they're leaving as. They're leaving as a rigid athlete. So trying to end every session with some sort of dynamic movement to, you know, hopefully mitigate some of those effects with just like low intensity skips, pogos, medicine ball throws, like things that are just fluid in nature. As opposed to some of the more dynamic strength stuff or maximal effort strength stuff, it just intuitively has made sense to me. And I think it's just a good way to cool down and like walking out the weight room in like a performance state, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And well, a couple of rabbit holes to go down with that one. I competed in weightlifting for a while, so read a lot of like Russian manuals, whatever else. Big fan of the Russian weightlifter, Dmitry Klokov. And in a lot of their training as weightlifters, where they're laying down very rigid fascial lines, they would always end training with some sort of depth jump, right? Something at the end to kind of, as Klokov said, like bring the bounce back or something like that. Mm. And then for Ross, you've had your hands in,
I love that,
Coach Bill Gillespie's manuals as well. And almost in every one of his summer workouts, as they would end, it would always end with jumping split squats. It'd be like three sets of six. So just really interesting how you start to see all these kind of pieces of what you were talking about, what these Russians were talking about, what Coach Bill was doing, all kind of revolving around that same thing. So can you give me an example of you're in season with soccer, you're on that +3 day, you might hit it hard in the weight room. Is it kind of just what you said, some easy kind of skips, hops or something, just to kind of bring some bounce back to them?
Yeah, I think the most popular one we do is just like an A skip, right? Just like, you know, super low impact, but it's fluid. You can feel the bounce a little bit. It's really easy. It's a good way to cool down. They're hopefully out of their shoes at that point. If I'm dealing with like a rehab case, like a lower extremity rehab case, we might do like a single leg pogo or even like medicine ball throws. Like I love medicine ball throws just because like it's very dynamic, but it's really such a low output, right? Like you can throw medicine balls all day and not really get tired. Like I've actually experimented on myself before and like, you know, I did like a scoop toss for distance and it took me like over 80 throws before I dropped off like a foot. Right. Wow. You know, okay. And it messed my back up for like a week, but from like a neural standpoint, like you're not really fatiguing from it. Like it's not that taxing, but it is very dynamic. So I just think there's a lot of inherent value in that. And it's very anecdotal, but it's really cool for me to hear, like, you know, you talk about like Klokov and like other people like that. Like, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but I, you know, I do think there is some benefit to it for sure.
And so when you are doing it, we're just going to call it like general strength training. Let's just say you have athletes coming in for whether it's summer bridge or, you know, first, second year on one of your teams. Do you have any solid strength to body weight ratios or certain metrics that like, okay, once you hit this level of general strength, going over that will be a little detrimental. You'll begin to get locked up. It's no longer beneficial. Anything like that for you?
Yeah. So like I would say I don't lean into those too much. I do have some things just kind of off the top of my head. Like, you know, I'd like to see a lot of guys, like if you can get like a 1.5 bench press, if you can trap bar two times your body weight, if you can do, you know, 10 perfect chin-ups, you know, for my entry level guys, you know, can you hold a plank for a minute with good pelvic position? Can you do 20 perfect push-ups with a pause at the bottom? Can you goblet squat? What is it? Half your body weight for 20 reps with perfect form. Right? Like those are just a couple things off the top of my head. But honestly, it's a lot more just eyeball for me. Okay. I've been really like fortunate and unfortunate at the same time to have some really uniquely structured kids come into my program. And it's just very obvious to me, the kids that are overly compressed from like too much weightlifting. And just looking between like force plate data, watching them move and having an understanding of like their pelvic and rib cage structure. Like it's more of a feel of like, okay, I know I need to move this kid on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. And then, along those lines, again, with like this idea of, max strength lays down rigid fascial lines, have you started to view training in a different way of like, okay, I used to really promote and pump up a split squat or a trap bar. Now we're going to focus more on pushing and pulling a sled. Like, have your exercises become a little bit more dynamic in nature now that you've like sort of had this awakening or thought, or is it still kind of like, no, we have to lay down that general strength. I'm just going to do some things differently at the end to kind of reestablish good patterns.
No, I think it more than anything is just a little bit more of a vertically integrated approach, right? Like, you know, I still think there's so much value in just general strength, especially for those like, I don't want to say like incoming or underdeveloped athletes. But yeah, I would say if anything, I've gravitated towards, because I've always had a speed and power bias, right? Like strength has never made sense to me in the sense that like it's the end all be all. Because like if you just watch sports, like nothing about it is that, unless you're a power lifter, right? Like,
yeah,
nothing about it is slow and strong. And I'm not saying, again, like it doesn't help. Like, so I've always had that bias. I guess if anything, I've gravitated towards much more of a movement based model in the sense of like, as opposed to chasing output, I'm now chasing efficiency and robustness, if that makes sense. Of like, all of these modalities are important, right? It's just to like what extent and at what time of the year can I afford to do it? Mm-hmm. And then like, more importantly, is just like how efficient of a mover can I make? Like, I would say like that's been my biggest aha moment of like last couple of years of like, because I've been down that rabbit hole of chasing outputs, and like it just led, and you know, and we had a lot of success from like, you know, a testing standpoint, but it it just didn't reap the benefits from like a robustness standpoint like I thought it would. So if anything now, man, I've just only probably become more foundational with the movement stuff, and then just gradually kind of like try to build out their toolbox or like their affordances, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. So kind of moving on, so to speak, Ross and Blair know at a conference, I'm going to ask a few questions. You now know from experience of being in the church basement with me, I'll ask a few questions there. So
legendary.
At your presentation, you had one of your athletes standing on this thing, and I asked, like, hey, what is that? And you said it was a neural mat. I love some voodoo. Can you go into just a little bit more depth and detail where you first saw it, why you use it, the benefits you think it has?
Yeah, so I should have shouted him out when you asked me during this, the presentation, but this is something I heard from Cal, actually, on a podcast. He, like, briefly mentions it, like, 6 years ago, just, like, this random name drop of Dr. Emily Splickle. And Dr. Emily Splickle, she's a podiatrist with a focus on performance. She wrote this book called Barefoot Strong. I got it right here, actually, because I was trying to get ready for today. It's 100 pages, but I think it's brilliant, man. It's really opened up my eyes of, like, how important the foot is. And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you guys have heard these guys talk about how, you know, important the foot is and, you know, how it connects the body to the world. And it really sets up the rest of the body for a lot of performance. But specifically with the neural mat, right? So if we look at the body, and if our body was built proportionally to, like, the amount of nerves in our body, we would be like 90% hands, feet, eyes, ears, and nose, right? Like, that's where, like, an overwhelming majority of our peripheral nerves are at, right? And that those nerves are designed to give our body information to use to form movement patterns, right? And what we see is with, and you guys know this, like, shoes have been a huge mistake for just, you know, society in general, right? There are a lot of them have this huge heel elevation with this really cushiony surface that just dampens these nerves in the foot, right? And just, like, you know, it just dulls them to proprioception and information, which causes a whole list of issues, especially if we're talking about, you know, athletes like soccer players. Like, you want to see something disgusting, look at a soccer player's feet. Their toes curl in like they're a gargoyle. But using certain textures, specifically a neural mat, which, shameless, like, you know, no free ads, but Dr. Emily Splickle sells, and she creates yoga mats and insoles you can put into your feet. They've shown to increase the stimulation and the sensory output, or I guess the sensory input that our body has or can, you know, receive. And I think just, like, one of the quotes that, like, I'm on a huge brain kick right now that I just love is, like, our output is only going to be as good as our input, right? So if our body doesn't have the sensory ability to take in information, it's naturally going to govern our outputs, right? So just using some of those things like the neural mat in different textures and exposing athletes to different surfaces, I just think it has a lot of inherent value to increase some of that sensory input.
Oh, I love it. And yeah, you hit the nail on the head. We're big feet guys here. Yeah. And it's so true. If you're listening to whether it's a presentation or a podcast with Cal, it always drops like one little tiny thing in there. So yeah. I thought you were going to talk about, like, I'm almost positive somewhere in Minnesota they have just like a room full of rocks and guys just like walk around on pebbles or something like that just to like re-stimulate the neural connections in their feet. So in an article you wrote on Sportsmith, which I highly recommend everybody go there and check those out, because not only are they phenomenal with just like listed out and worded out details and specifics and background and everything like that, but the video content is like phenomenal just to help put a picture and again like a video to what you're talking about. So within there you talked about communication with your ATs, right? So can you just go into a little bit of, obviously, men's soccer is your thing. Obviously, you have, you know, your hand in sports science and stuff, but also a lot of return to plays. Can you just talk about that relationship and the communication you have between your sports med staff there and kind of like your your systems here at Liberty, just because I think it'll be beneficial for everybody, no matter the setting or kind of like if they're early or later in their career.
Yeah. So I'll say this, man, it's a battle everywhere you go. I don't say this in like any boastful way, but like I've spoken to three different professional organizations from different sports leagues just in 2024. And this is probably the thing that gets asked the most. Right. And I say that just like to make clear, like the people listening, like this is a challenge everywhere at every level. I think a lot of people think like they get this idea of like, oh, like this would never happen at like the highest levels and stuff like that. Like, no, it's a challenge everywhere, man. Like people ask me all the time, like, is it hard to work with athletes? Like the egos and entitlement and stuff like that. Athletes for me are easy. It's the staff that's tough to work with, right? Like that's where we start getting into issues. So I just want to make it clear, like there's no perfect way to do it. And like, it's going to be a challenge at every level. I guess for me and where I found the most success is finding ways to create simple models where each person has clearly defined roles throughout the rehab process, but can take autonomy of that role is huge, right? So for like, it could be something as simple as like, hey, I'm going to take the compound and the dynamic stuff. You feel free to take all the isolated stuff, right? It could really be that simple. Or it could be, hey, on Mondays, can you do more isometric, like let's say like a hamstring, right? So like what something that, you know, I was recently talking to, like, you know, a really high level practitioner about was like, Mondays and Thursdays, we're going to go isometrics in the training room and we're going to do our high speed workout on the field. And then Tuesdays and Fridays, we're going to go our change of direction, extensive, dynamic contractions in the training room. Right. And then Wednesdays off and so on and so forth. And just kind of this rolling cycle, right? This 3-day rolling cycle of isometrics, high speed, dynamic contractions and change of direction work, yada, yada, yada. Right. And just creating these like very clearly defined roles in, you know, models to me, like is so apparent, to allowing people to like, one, take ownership of their work, right? Cause that's the biggest challenge, right? Is like, I think ATs, especially in sports medicine, especially like they understand that they're responsible for a lot of these cases and they get very concerned when other people want to feel like, you know, they're stepping on their toes. Right. And that's inherent, right? Like I'd be pissed off too, if my AT ever came to me and was like, hey, like, you know, I think you should really change up this squat progression, right? Like,
yeah.
I'd kick him out pretty quick. But like, I just think clearly defining roles and then giving people room to autonomously operate in, I think is so huge.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so when you first came to Liberty, were there some of those kind of like methods and protocols in place and you modified them, or is it just like you just sat down in a room and you went to war kind of getting these things up and going?
Yeah, no, it's there was really nothing in place. It was really trainer to trainer. And in a lot of ways, it still is.
Yeah.
What I can say is that we are finally at a point now where like with some of these more consistent injuries, especially like these long-term injuries, like ACLs, for example, like we've at least developed a system and a layout that I feel like everyone's started to operate under. And it's one of those things, like it's still a continuous battle every day to like try to hold people accountable to that. Yeah.
All right. And then the last kind of follow-up here, and then we'll pass it over to Blair. Help me, like, how do you do it all? Like, how are you doing all this? Like with all the athletes that get hurt, are you in the weight room in there one-on-one with them, scheduling times around them? Or is it like, hey, from 2 to 3 p.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, this is all my knee people. On this day, it's going to be all my shoulder. Like, how are you actually doing all this?
Yeah. So it's not nearly as in depth as like, you know, one-on-one with every single injury case, mm-hmm. right? Like I don't have the time to accomplish this. Right. Yeah. So really I would say what it is as soon as kids get off the training room table, and they get sent back over to the performance side of things, that's where I will start to have my hand in the process. And I will just assist and work through the other assistants on staff to see if, like, to help them with that. Mm-hmm. Let's say, for example, like, we have a girl that gets hurt on the lacrosse team, which is like 40 girls, right? She gets sent back to training. She can start some, you know, some movement stuff. If that coach has time to work with them one-on-one, great. I'll have my hand in it, oversee them, and try to help guide them. If, hey, the only time she can make it is during the team lift, cool. Let me come help, right? So I'd say that's probably the way that we've scaled it the best, is just like doing whatever I can to try to help the other people on the staff. And then if there's some like special needs cases, kind of hopping in a little bit more one-on-one basis from there.
All right. No, that's helpful. Cause I was just like, it's hundreds of athletes every year. And then a large percentage that are going to get hurt, a smaller percentage that are going to be like, you know, long term, protocols for rehabilitation and conditioning. And I was just like, how is this possible? Like, how is this guy actually doing that? So thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate just a little insight onto the logistics side of things. Blair, what do you got here, brother?
Man, I've been sitting here like, which direction am I going to go? What direction am I going to take this? One thing I was thinking about when you're talking about fascial lines being rigid from too much strength work was yesterday I had an athlete in. He's a sophomore, and kid is just locked up because all he does is lift. Football player. He wants to be the strongest kid in the school. He is probably the strongest kid in the school, but literally walks around hunchback, can't move at all. And so I've been tasked with giving him some mobility work. Yesterday, I stole a program from Trevor Funk. I don't know if you guys follow Trevor Funk, but he's a Tommy John disciple. And he's got a spinal hygiene program. So all it is 20, 30 seconds of pogo jumps. And then you're going to do some like cervical rotation, 20 each way. And then you'll go like cervical flexion extension and then work your way down the spine basically into rolling and all this stuff. So the kid does it and he's like, I don't feel good. I feel like too loose. It's like, dude, you're so locked up that finally like you're mobile. Like he comes back an hour later. He's like, I feel amazing. And I'm like, you just got to move more, man. You just, all he does is everything is bench and squat and that's it. And the kid is just locked. So that's what I thought of with that. And it just goes back to like, we need to be dynamic. We need to be moving. You need to work in different planes and directions. And it can't all just be the maximal strength work. Moving on from that. You guys know I'm a barefoot guy, wear the barefoot shoes like a goober. So I'm all in on the barefoot strong. I actually haven't read that book, but I'm going to get on that and go down that rabbit trail even further. Connor, do you wear the barefoot shoe or are you in your running shoes and then you just take them off whenever you can?
No, I don't do the barefoot shoes with like the toes.
No.
Way too
self-conscious. I'm not doing the toes. I can't do that, but.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm too self-conscious for that. But yeah, I got me a pair of Vivos, and I love them, man. The only shitty thing about them is they get wet. It's game over. They stink. But yeah, no, I'm a big fan of those, man. I love those. And like, to be honest, you could probably get away with like even a wide pair of Vans would probably, you know, I think accomplish just about the same thing. But yeah, I'm barefoot as soon as I can be. That's 90% of the reason I do this job is I can wear sweatpants to work every day and walk around my weight room barefoot without anybody getting too upset with me. So yeah. And then especially for my athletes, like unless we're going to be dropping stuff on the ground, if I can get them barefoot, we're going to be barefoot.
Yeah. I take crap from our athletic trainers cause I let the kids be barefoot in the gym. They think it's a liability, but I'm like, if they drop a plate on their foot with shoes on, it's not going to make a difference. Yeah. It's kind of, I try not to have them lift too much barefoot, but like when we're moving around, go ahead. It's fine. Be smart about it. From there, I wanted to ask you, I've been super, super impressed what you put out social media with your reconditioning protocols, your progressions. with the rehab type stuff. Without getting too specific into one injury or another, can you just talk about where you started with that, kind of how it's progressed for you, what you're focused on now? I think it was we had Alex Effer on, and he was basically saying like he spends 6 months at a time, focus on the ankle, focus on the knee, focus on the hip. Is that what it's like for you, or are you kind of breadth and not depth? Where are you at?
Yeah, so I would say I could barely keep my attention for an hour, let alone 6 months on one thing. You guys know how it is. Like I probably have like six projects going on right now that I try to spread myself out to. So I would say is this, like in terms of like that specifically, like the way that I learn is I basically find it's generally what happens is we have an injury case here that I just get super interested in. And then I pretty much just go down that rabbit hole for like 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Like I spend all day, every day listening to podcasts, reading articles. If I know somebody in the field, which like I've started to like develop a little bit of like a network now, of like somebody I know that's good with this kind of injury, I'm reaching out to them. Like, hey, just like whatever insight you can give me. And then from there, like I pretty much just create a protocol. And which generally just turns into a presentation. I have like a dozen of them at this point. Because that's just how I learn. Like I have to get it on paper. I have to get it in front of me. I have to get it organized into phases, methods, objectives, exit criterias, and at least have some sort of like system in place, or else it's just going to fall out of my brain and I'm just not going to be able to conceptualize it the way I need to. Mostly because of my ADD. So it's kind of where I'm at with it right now.
I'm on the same page with that. I read and I listen to podcasts like crazy, and I don't remember 25% of it. Mm-hmm. If I don't put it on paper, or I don't put it somewhere, then it's gone, or most of it's gone.
Yeah.
touching on the neural side of things, I saw you post about infinity walks, and I went down the infinity walk rabbit hole a little bit. I don't know. I think it was Chris that turned me on to it. So I've used them as well, usually as like a part of a warm up, just to get the brain going. How often are you kind of including the sensory training? Is it mostly a kind of return to play protocol, or is it with everybody?
Yeah, so I'd say this, and you know, I first got put on to them when you know Chris was talking about it, and I'd heard about them years ago from like Cal talking about like some of the goat walks and some of that stuff, and I just kind of blew it off, and then talked to Chris about it actually a little bit. And like, so I kind of wanted to look back into it because I was on this big brain kick, started to look like where they originally came from and stuff like that. And like all the benefits, of not just infinity walks, but just like trying to attack the brain. Right. And like how impactful the brain is on injuries specifically. So for me, I would say this, it's not often I do it in the team setting. I just haven't found a good way to scale it yet. Just with like the time and, you know, the setup and all the stuff like that, like haven't had a lot of success with trying to do that. I'd say this, it's how I start out every rehab scenario though, every session. We'll warm up and then we'll get into our brain game is what I call it. We just call it brain gains. And, you know, we'll just do something reactionary, something with one eye closed, something with an infinity walk, something with, you know, I've got this, I recently got sent some YouTube videos by a guy named Corey Peterson. Corey was actually at U of M with Cal, and he's at St. Thomas now, but he's going to be putting out a product here soon with like all these like different flashing colors and numbers and transitions and like all these things that are really just like YouTube videos. And like I can manipulate the speed to go faster. And so I've just been messing with that as much as I can. And I'd be lying to say there's like a lot of progression to it. It's really just like, okay, like how creative can I get with this thing and challenge this athlete mentally before we go back to, or before we get into some of the more like general rehab stuff.
I love that. My last question for you, and it's a bit of a jump to a different subject, but seeing you talk about using isometrics and eccentrics, and I don't want to make too specific of a question, just how are you using them? You can go as deep or specific as you want.
Yeah. So I'll say like tempo training, something we're going to like in some capacity is going to be implemented year round, whether that's just like a 2 second pause on something or some sort of extensive isometric to, for, you know, tendon health or something like that. I mean, everybody's running some sort of triphasic setup now, right? Like, you know, if you talk to anybody, they're going to have a 2 to 3, 4 week block, and it's going to look a little bit different for everybody, but whether they're doing some sort of, you know, eccentric contractions, isometrics, you know, into concentric. I guess for me, like from like the big picture standpoint, like, you know, if I was working with like any field and core sport team, really, like after the season, we'll go into like isodynamics, which are basically just like a 10 second isometric hold at a deep end range of motion followed by 10 reps. And it's just, you know, I just emphasizing full range of motion, movement competency inherently because of the tempo, you're going to be at a lighter load, right? It's just, we get some occlusion, right? If you stress the tissue, your brain's going to send blood flow to that area. And just kind of promote, you know, some regeneration type stuff. We'll get into some general strength training. Then we'll come back. We'll hit our heavy eccentrics. We'll hit our heavy isometrics or overcoming isometrics. And then we'll just get into our dynamic effort stuff. So I would say, like, from that standpoint, that's generally, like, for the most part, like, the general layouts, you know, like, getting into more, like, the specific, like, isometrics specifically, which I would say I use probably a little bit more than most people. I just love, like, for me, man, like, one, especially working with soccer athletes, like, I just get such a cost-benefit analysis or such, like, a cost-benefit ratio of, you know, huge stimulus at a very minimal cost. Right? Like, they're just not nearly as fatiguing as dynamic strength training is. And we can maintain so many qualities with it. Two, like, we can just manipulate it so many different ways. So, like, whether that's, you know, absolute strength, capacity, dynamic effort work, like, super specific joint angles that we want to work on. Like, I think there's so many different ways that we can manipulate it to get, like, super specific adaptations that are super easy to teach. Right. Like, I think, like, you know, I love the Bruce Schechter quote, like, you can be intense or complex, but you can't be both. Right. So just by, like, the ability to put an athlete in, like, one position and, like, hey, like, let's just go as hard as you can here. Right. Like, yeah, I just think there's, you get so much stimulus out of that. And then lastly, it's just like, especially like if you come watch my like incoming class training, like, it's just extensive isometrics pretty much the whole time. And that's just because there's so much motor learning. Right. Like, it's like the simplest principle. It goes back to, like you said, right? Like, if you want to get good at something or if you want to get good at an area, spend time working on that area, right? Like, if you want to get stronger in deeper ranges of motion, spend time in deeper ranges of motion, right? Like, I think it really is that simple. So just, like, for me, just, like, there's just so many different benefits. I mean, it's so agile, which I think it just lends itself to, like, the environment that I'm working in right now so much.
I've really, in the high school setting, I've really loved the long, slow ISOs. I don't know how much my kids love them. They're always complaining. And I think a lot of times it's more mental than it is physical. Like, 20 seconds isn't really that long. You can hang out a lot longer than that. But they get in their head, they're like, oh, this hurts. And but as far as finding positions, getting strong and long in those positions sometimes, I think it's been really valuable.
Yeah, I think, like, even Chris, I think you've talked about this a little bit with some of, like, Franz Bosch's stuff, and just the idea of, like, and I may be butchering what you're saying, so let me know if I am, but, like, the idea of, like, attractor positions, and just, like, athletes are inherently going to take the least path of resistance, so if I can put them into a good position and make them really strong there, like, that's what they're going to revert to in chaotic situations of sport, right? So, like, it's, like, the metaphor that I always use is, like, you know, I grew up in South Dakota where it snows 9 months a year. And, like, you know, if you grow up on, like, a farm, there's the long driveway, right? Like, you're never going to drive where the tracks aren't, right? You're always going to follow the path. So if I can just lay that path down consistently over time and make you really strong there, that's inherently what they're going to gravitate towards. I just think that is so huge.
That's a
great. Did I get that right, Chris?
Yeah. Absolutely. A great analogy. And the deeper the ruts of the path, when you do fluctuate a little bit, it'll pull you back in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really good. I like that. Yeah. And it's also a bit of a DB Hammer, where he always talks about like your critical joint configuration, or in other words, like the worst position, the bottom position, then your prime anatomical position, or like that top spot. So if you're doing like an isometric mid thigh pull, you just imagine doing it with, you know, your hands on your shoelaces, that would be your worst position. And then at the very top range, that would be your best. So yeah, no, it's all comes together at the end of the day.
All right. That's it for me. Chris, you want to finish this off here?
Yeah. Ross, did you have any other kind of follow-ups or anything?
Nope. We all crushed it. Connor, you did great, dude. You killed it.
But, hey, Connor, thanks for coming on here, man, and just taking some time to answer some questions. And is there anything you want to plug right now, or just kind of give out your social medias? And obviously, we'll cover those too, but just for the people out there.
Yeah. Social media, it's just Connor Schepp, ConnorSchoepp, I think, on Instagram and Twitter, LinkedIn. You know, if anyone's listening to this and, you know, there's something you want me to expand on, feel free to hit me up. I'm happy to share literally anything. So if I can be a resource for somebody, just let me know.
Awesome. What do you have coming down the pipeline? Another article, presentation? What are you thinking?
Oh, okay. I guess it'll be the first place. Writing a book right now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to bridge this gap between injury and performance. So if you're listening to this, I'm hoping it's, you know, within the calendar year, but hopefully to have that out here later on in 2024. So yeah, awesome. That's probably the biggest project right now.
Heck yeah. We'll have to send you the, I don't think it's out yet, so the bootleg edition of a podcast we did with Mike Boyle. Cause I asked him that question of like, how do you write a book? Like what are your steps?
Right? Oh,
I haven't heard anybody ask him that. And like, he's put out so much content. Like, okay, single leg training, I get it. But like, how do you do what you do? So go into a little bit, if you don't mind, like if it's not like too much revealing of like, what's your process like? Is it a daily 1,000 words? Is it a daily 30 minutes, an hour? Like, what's that for you?
So it's been a constant battle. So I'll say this. I have this guy helping me by the name of Phil White. Okay. Phil Wright wrote Game Changers with Fergus Connolly. He also wrote Unplugged. Unbelievable dude. And I basically just reached out to him to like, hey, I'm like, hey, can you give me some advice? To where now he basically emails me or texts me like once a week to make sure that I'm continuing to do it and like actually holds me accountable to doing it. Mm-hmm. And he's been a huge resource. He's hooked me up with a bunch of people. So I would say that'd be the biggest thing is like, if you're ever thinking about doing something like that, reach out to people that have done it before, because it is a world, man. Like, I had no idea what I was getting into. There's a lot of things that you would never even like think to consider when trying to write something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's like different ways to do it, right? Like, if you're just going to put out a PDF, that's one thing. But like, if you want to like publish it, like self-publish versus going to somebody, like there's all these different things. But I guess for me, man, I spent some time just researching. And then the next thing I just did, man, is I think I'm at like 10 chapters now. And then I just wrote down 8 bullet points for each chapter, mm-hmm. and then just started knocking my way down. All right. And I'm getting closer to the end of the first draft. From there, we'll send it out to somebody to edit, like a colleague. Then we'll do like an official edit where I'll send it to like a actual public editing company. And then there we'll go to like an actual publishing company, which will hopefully, help me kind of like design the cover, fix the layout for me. And then, you know, I'll basically just self-publish from there on Amazon is kind of the plan right now, but yeah.
So unreal. Well, I'll say this, if you need a model for the cover, no charge here. I've been working on this body for years, like a fake an injured leg or something.
There you go.
What has been the learning experience in this process that you weren't ready for or weren't expecting? Like, what has come out of it where you're like, wow, this has been a great benefit. I can't believe how much I learned from this or whatever else.
Oh, well, just like the biggest challenge, like what I've learned the most is just how much of a challenge it is, man, to just stay consistent with something like that. Like, I like you guys know how it is, man. You get so busy in this field and it's like, it just takes up so much of your time. And like, you know, it's something like this, like, oh, like I'm going to make it work. And like, man, like I've had a lot of like 2 to 3 week gaps in between this thing. And like, it's so daunting to like get back up on the horse and keep going. But it really is, man. Like the power of consistency is everything. Mm-hmm. Like just writing, but just like everything. Like if you can just show up and do 20 minutes a day, even if you don't get anything down, man, just the fact that you're trying to get it on paper and trying to put something out and building that pattern, man. Like I just think like for me, it's been so huge and only just reaffirmed like the idea of like creating systems and like, you know, trying to find ways to, you know, create patterns for your life that are going to set you up for success. It's probably the best way, like someone's put it for me. Like you really are what you emphasize. And like, if you can't find time for something, it's probably not that important to you. And like, so that's been like a harsh reality check for me of like, this is something I've dreamed about my whole life, like kind of a bucket list thing of like, you know, legacy and understanding that, you know, no day is guaranteed. And like, mm-hmm. you know, I could be gone tomorrow for all I know. And like, for me, trying to just find some way for like, you know, I don't want to say like live on, that's probably a little too deep, but just like, you know, something I could be proud of, man. That's, you know, that's going to, you know, continue hopefully to help, you know, if I can just help one person with this thing, man, it's going to be enough for me. And, you know, trying to, you know, make time for that and just be consistent with that has been a huge eye-opening experience for me.
And I think that that's the perfect way to wrap it up, as we just came completely full circle, where at the very top of the show, you talked about like your heart for coaching and just wanting to give back and wanting to be there and everything. And come now again, full circle to writing a book again, like you just said, if you could help one person out there, if you could go back and help yourself when, you know, you were first starting out, it's absolutely worth it. Having written a few articles, I can't imagine trying to tackle a book. It's an absolute grind. It's so hard. You write for 5 hours and then you completely erase everything that you just wrote. And yeah, you go through your highs and lows. So we'll be thinking about you, praying for you, and can't wait to hopefully have you on again, or at least really dive into it once it finally comes out. Connor, thanks so much, man. Thanks for taking the time. And let's go Flames here. We got four current or former Flames on this bad boy. I love it. Appreciate it, Connor. Thanks, buddy.
George. Yep, thanks, boys.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Victory Over Self Radio. Episodes are available anywhere you listen to podcasts. We also have videos and clips of each episode on our Victory Over Self Radio YouTube channel. Like and subscribe and let us know if there's any person or topic you'd like us to cover. See y'all next time.